The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Etang santang, etang panitang, yadidang sabba sankhara samato, sabbo padhipati nissaggo, Annakyo, virago, nirodho, nibbana.
This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, this is the 14th sermon in the series of sermons on nibbana. In our last sermon, we gave a description of the forms of imaginings or mithinkings which the Buddha had compared to an extremely subtle bondage of Maya. The Yavakalapi Sutta of the Salayatana Sanyutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya has shown us that all kinds of thoughts concerning existence that stem from this subtle conceit Asmimana are mere imaginings or mythinkings, and that they are called a bondage of Maya because they have the power to keep beings shackled to existence.
We have seen how they follow a dichotomy, even like the dilemma posed by the fivefold bondage of Vepachitti, the king of demons. Whether one thinks I shall be or I shall not be, one is in bondage to Mara. Whether one thinks I shall be percipient or I shall be non-percipient or I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient, one is still in bondage to Mara. There is a dichotomy involved here. The fact that these imaginings which follow a dichotomy must be transcended completely, as well as the way to transcend them, has been preached by the Buddha to Venerable Pukkusati in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya.
There is a pithy passage forming the grand finale of this discourse in which the Buddha gives a resume. We propose to quote this passage at the very outset as it scintillates with the majestic fervor of the Dhamma.
Yathathitam manyusava napavattanti manyusave khopana napavattamani muni santoti vuchyatiti iti khopane tanguttam kinchetam patichyabuttam asmiti bhikkhu manyitametam ayamaham asmiti manyitametam bhavissanti manyitametam na bhavissanti manyitametam rupi bhavissanti manyitametam arupi bhavissanti manyitametam sanye bhavissanti manyitametam asanye bhavissanti manyitametam nivasanye nasanye bhavissanti manyitametam manyitam bhikkhu rogo manyitam gando manyitam sallam sabba manyitanam tveva bhikkhu samatikkama muni santo tibucchati Muni khopana bhikkhu santo na jayati, na jiyati, na miyati, na kuppati, na piheti. Tampisa bhikkhu nathi yena jayath, ajaya mano king jiyisati, ajiya mano king miyisati, amiya mano king kuppisati, akuppa mano kissa pihisati. Yathattitang manyusava napavattanti, manyusave khopana napavattamani, Muni santuti vuchyati iti yang tang buttang idametang patichya buttang.
In the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, we find the Buddha presenting some points as the theme and gradually developing it, analyzing, clarifying and expatiating as the discourse proceeds. The opening sentence in the above paragraph is a quotation of a part of that original statement of the Buddha, which forms the theme. Here is the rendering. Steadied whereon the tides of imaginings no longer occur in him,
And when the tides of imaginings occur no more in him, he is called a sage stilled. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said, I am monk is something imagined. I am this is something imagined. I shall be is something imagined. I shall not be is something imagined. I shall be possessed of form is something imagined. I shall be formless is something imagined. I shall be percipient is something imagined. I shall be non-percipient is something imagined. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is something imagined. The imagined is a disease. The imagined is an abscess. The imagined is a dart. It is with the surmounting of all what is imagined, man, that a sage is called stilled. The sage who is stilled is not born, nor does he age, nor does he die, nor is he shaken, and he has no longing. Even that is not in him whereby he might be born. Not being born, how shall he age? Not aging, how shall he die? Not dying, how shall he be shaken? Being unshaken, what shall he long for? So it was with reference to this that it was said, steadied whereon the tides of imaginings no longer occur in him, he is called a sage stilled. All this goes to show how relevant the question of imaginings is to the path leading to Nibbana. This pithy passage, which brings the discourse to a climax, portrays how the sage is at peace when his mind is released by stemming the tides of imaginings. He attains release from birth, decay and death, here and now, because he has realized the cessation of existence in this very world. It is in this light that we have to interpret the above statement, even that is not in him whereby he might be born. Dependent on existence is birth. Due to whatever postulate of existence one can speak of a birth, even that existence is not in him. Not being born, how can he age? How can he grow old or decay? This is because of the implicit interrelation between conditions. Here we can flash back to our analogy of a tree mentioned earlier. In order to explain the mutual interrelation between the concepts of birth, decay and death, we brought up a simile which, however, is not canonical. That is to say, supposing there is some kind of tree, the buds, the leaves, the flowers, the fruits and the wood of which could be sold for making one's livelihood. If 5 men trading in each of those items respectively are made to line up at some particular stage in the growth of a tree and asked whether the tree is too young or too old, the answers given might differ according to the individual standpoint grasped in each case. It turns out to be a difference of viewpoint. For instance, the man who makes his living by selling the buds would reply that the tree is too old when the buds turn into leaves. Similarly, when it is the season for the leaves to fall and the flowers to bloom, one who trades in leaves might say that the tree is too old. And when flowers turn into fruits, the florist's viewpoint would be similar. In this way, one can understand how this concept changes according to what one grasps, that there is an implicit relativity about it. Now, as for this sage, he has given up everything that he had grasped. Grasping has been given up completely. Imagining too has been abandoned. Hence, not being born, how shall he age? The sage has no postulate of existence. Since there is no existence, there is no birth. Because there is no birth, there is no decay. It is a well-known fact that the term jara implies both growth and decay. It is after setting a limit that we speak of a process of decay after growth. This limit, however, varies according to our individual standpoint grasped, according to our point of view. That is what we have tried to illustrate by this analogy. Then we have the statement, not aging, how shall he die? Since decay is an approach to death, where there is no decay, there is no death. The fact that there is no death, we have already seen in our exposition of the significance of the verses quoted above from Adhimatta Theragatha. When the bandits got round to kill the venerable Adhimutta, he declared, Nami hoti aho sinti bhavissanti na hoti me sankhara vibhavissanti tathaka paridevana. It does not occur to me, I was, nor does it occur to me, I shall be. Mere preparations will get destroyed. What is there to lament? This declaration exemplifies the above statement. When all graspings are given up, there is no decay or death. Amiyamano kinkuppissati. Not dying, how shall he be shaken? The verb kuppati does not necessarily mean getting annoyed. Here it means to be shaken up or moved. When one holds on to a standpoint, one gets shaken up if someone else tries to dislodge him from that standpoint. The deliverance in Nibbana is called akuppacheto vimutti, the unshakable deliverance of the mind. All other deliverances of the mind known to the world are shakable. Kuppa, they are unsteady. They shake before the pain of death. Only Nibbana is called akuppa cheto vimutti, the unshakable deliverance of the mind. So this peaceful sage, the Arahant, established in that concentration of the fruit of Arahantship, Arahatta Phala Samadhi, which is known as the influx-free deliverance of the mind, anasava cheto vimutti, and is endowed with the wisdom proper to Arahantship, Panya Vimutti, deliverance through wisdom, is unshaken before death. His mind remains unshaken. That is why the Arahant Thera, Venerable Adhimutta, fearlessly made the above declaration to the bandits. Now, as to the significance of the Buddha's statement, Amiyamano king kuppissati, akuppamano kissapihissati, not dying, how shall he be shaken? And being unshaken, what shall he long for? When there is no shock, no agitation or trembling, what does one long for? Piha means longing, desiring for something or other. In this context, it refers to that longing which arises at the moment of death in one who has not destroyed craving. It is as a consequence of that longing that he enters some form of existence according to his karma. That longing is not there in this sage for the simple reason that he is unshaken before death. He has nothing to look forward to, no desires or longings. Akuppamano kissa pihessati. Being unshaken, what shall he long for? It is obvious, therefore, that the concepts of birth, decay and death become meaningless to this sage. That is precisely why he is at peace, having transcended all imaginings. All this goes to show that Nibbana is a state beyond decay and death. We can clearly understand from this discourse why Nibbana is known as a decayless, deathless state, realizable in this very world. That sage has conquered decay and death here and now, because he has realized the cessation of existence here and now. This is something extremely wonderful about the Arahant. He realizes the cessation of existence in his attainment to the fruit of Arahanthood. How does he come to realize the cessation of existence? Craving is extinct in him, hence there is no grasping. Where there is no grasping, there is no existence. Precisely because there is no existence, birth, decay and death, along with sorrow and lamentation, cease altogether. From the foregoing, we could well infer that all those concepts like birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair come about as a result of a heap of pervert perceptions, pervert thoughts and pervert views based on the conceit of an existence, the conceit M. The three kinds of perversions known as sanya vipallasa, chitta vipallasa and ditthi vipallasa give rise to a mass of concepts of an imaginary nature. The entire mass of suffering summed up by the terms birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are basically of a mental origin. For an illustration of this fact, we can go back to our analogy of winding some strands into a rope mentioned earlier. We pointed out that in the case of some strands that are being mistakenly wound in the same direction, it is the grasp in the middle that gives at least the semblance of a rope to it. So long as there is no such grasping, the strands do not become knotty or tense as they go round and round. It is only when someone grasps it in the middle that the strands begin to get winded up, knotty and tense. What is called existence or becoming, bhava, follows the same norm. True to the law of impermanence, everything in the world changes. But there is something innocent in this change. Impermanence is innocuous in itself. We say it is innocuous because it means no harm to anyone. It is simply the nature of this world, the suchness, the known. It can do us harm only when we grasp, just as in the case of that quasi rope. The tenseness between winding and unwinding, arising out of that grasp in the middle, is comparable to what is called bhava-sankhara, preparations for existence. Sankhara or preparations are said to be dependent on avijja or ignorance. Now we can form an idea of the relationship between these two even from this analogy of the rope. The grasp in the middle creates two ends giving rise to a dilemma. In the case of existence too, grasping leads to an antinomian conflict. To become a thing is to disintegrate into another thing. On a previous occasion, we happened to discuss the significance of the term manyana, me thinking or imagining, with reference to the verse yena yena hi manyanti tato tang hoti anyatha, etc. Manyana itself gives rise to a thing which from its very inception goes on disintegrating into another thing. Just as much as grasping leads to the concept of two ends, to become a thing is to start changing into another thing. That is, it comes under the sway of the law of impermanence. Illustrations of this norm are sometimes to be met with in the discourses, but their significance is often ignored. The idea of the two ends and the middle sometimes finds expression in the reference to an above, below and across in the middle, uddham, adho, tiriyam, majje, or in the terms before, behind and middle, pure, paccha, majjham. Such references deal with some deep aspects of the dhamma relating to nibbana. As a good illustration,
we may take up the following two verses from the Mettagu Manava Puccha in the Parayana Vagga of the Sutta Nipata.
Yankinchi sampajanasi buddhaṃ adho tiriyañcāpi majje etesu nandiñca nivesanañca panujya viññāṇaṃ bhave natitthe evaṃ vihāri sato appamatto bhikkhu caraṃ hitvā mamāyitāni jāti jaraṃ soka pariddavañca idheva vidvā pajaheya dukkhaṃ.
Whatever you may know to be above, below and across in the middle, dispel the delight and the tendency to dwell in them. Then your consciousness will not remain in existence. A monk endowed with understanding, thus dwelling mindful and heedful, as he fares along giving up all possessions, would abandon even here and now birth, decay, sorrow, lamentation and suffering. The word idheva occurring in the second verse is highly significant in that it means the abandonment of all those things here and now, not leaving it for an existence to come. In the Mahavihuha Sutta of the Sutta Nipata also, a similar emphasis is laid on this idea of here and now. About the Arahant, it is said that he has no death or birth here and now. Chutupapato idha yassa natthi, to whom even here there is no death or birth. In this very world, he has transcended them by making those two concepts meaningless. The word nivesanam occurring in the first verse is also significant. It means dwelling. In consciousness, there is a tendency to dwell in. That is why in some contexts it is said that form is the abode or dwelling place of consciousness.
Rupa dhatu kho ghapati vijnanasya oko. The form element householder is the abode of consciousness. The terms oka, niketa and nivesana are synonymous, meaning abode, home or dwelling place. The nature of consciousness in general is to abide or dwell in. That non-manifestative consciousness, anidassana vijnana, however, has got rid of the tendency to abide or dwell in. Now we can revert to the passage in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, which speaks of an occurrence of tides of imaginings. The passage actually begins with the words Yathattitang manyusava napavattanti, steadied whereon the tides of imaginings occur no more in him. The idea behind the occurrence of tides of imaginings is quite often represented by the concept of asava, influx. Sensuality, karma, existence, power, views, ditthi and ignorance, avijja, are referred to as influxes, asava, or floods, ogha. These are the four kinds of samsaric habits that continuously flow into the minds of beings. The above mentioned sutta passage refers to a place steadied whereon the tides of imaginings do not occur or flow in, a place that is free from their influence. This is none other than Nibbana, for which one of the epithets used is Deepa or island. Since Nibbana is called an island, some might take it literally to mean some sort of a place in this world. In fact, this is the general concept of Nibbana some are prone to uphold in their interpretation of Nibbana. But why it is called an island is clearly explained for us by a discourse in the Parayana Vagga of the Sutta Nipata, namely Kappa Manava Puccha. In this sutta, the Brahmin youth Kappa poses the following question to the Buddha.
Majhe sarasming tithatang oghe jate mahabhaye jara machu paretanang deepang pabruhi marisa tvancha me deepang akkahi yathaidang naparang siya. To them that stand midstream, so said the venerable Kappa, when the frightful floods flow forth, to them in decay and death forlorn, an island sire may you proclaim, an island which none else excels. Yeah, such an isle, pray tell me, sire. And this is the Buddha's reply to it. Akinchanam anadanam etam deepam anaparam nibbanamiti nam bhumi jaramachu parikhyam. Owning not, grasping not, the isle is this, none else besides. Nibbana, that's how I call that isle, wherein decay is decayed and death is death. The Buddha's reply makes it clear that the term Nibbana stands for the extinction of craving and grasping. The ideal of owning not and grasping not is itself Nibbana and nothing else. If the term had any other connotation, the Buddha would have mentioned it in this context. It is indubitably clear then that the epithet Deepang or island has to be understood in a deeper sense when it refers to Nibbana. It is that owning nothing and grasping nothing that puts an end to decay and death. Though we have yet to finish the discussion of the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, the stage is already set now to understand the significance of a certain brief discourse in the Udana, which is very often quoted in discussions on Nibbana. For the facility of understanding, we shall take it up now, as it somehow fits into the context. Athi bhikkave ajatam abhutam akatam asankhatam. Nochetam bhikkave abhavisya ajatam abhutam akatam asankhatam. Na idha jatasya bhutasya katasya sankhatasya nisaranam panyayetha. Yasmacha kho bhikkave athi ajatam abhutam akatam asankhatam tasma jātasya bhūtasya katasya saṅkhatasya nissaraṇaṁ paññāyati. Monks, there is a not born, a not become, a not made, a not compounded. Monks, if that not born, not become, not made, not compounded were not, there would be no stepping out here from what is born, become, made and compounded. But since monks there is a not born, a not become, a not made, a not compounded, therefore there is a stepping out from what is born, become, made, compounded. The terms ajatam, not born, abhutam, not become, akatam, not made, and asankhatam, not compounded, are all epithets for Nibbana. The Buddha declares that if not for this not born, not become, not made, not compounded, there would be no possibility of stepping out or release here, that is in this very world, from the born, the become, the made and the compounded. The second half of the passage rhetorically reiterates and emphasizes the same fact. Now as to the significance of this profound declaration of the Buddha, we may point out that the terms not born, not become, not made, not compounded suggest the emancipation of the Arahant's mind from birth, becoming and preparations, Sankhara. They refer to the cessation of birth, becoming and preparations realized by the Arahant. So then the significance of these terms are purely psychological. But the commentator, the Venerable Dhammapala, pays little attention to the word idha here in this passage, which needs to be emphasized. The fact that there is a possibility here and now of stepping out from the state of born, become, made and compounded surely deserves emphasis, since until then release from decay and death was thought to be possible only in another dimension of existence, that is, after death. The prospect of stepping out from decay and death here and now in this very world has to be asserted for its novelty, which is why the declaration opens with the word athi, there is. However, most of the scholars who try to interpret this passage in their discussions on Nibbana, instead of laying stress on the word idha, here emphasize the opening word atthi, there is, to prove that Nibbana is some form of reality absolutely existing somewhere. As that passage from the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta on Manyana, which we discussed, has shown us, the terms Ajatam, Abhutam, Akatam and Asankhatam have to be understood in a deeper sense. Existence is a conceit deep-rooted in the mind, which gives rise to a heap of pervert notions. Its cessation, therefore, has also to be accomplished in the mind and by the mind. This is the gist of the Buddha's exhortation. Let us now come back to the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta to discuss another facet of it. We started our discussion with the grand finale of that discourse because of its relevance to the question of Manyana. However, as a matter of fact, this discourse preached by the Buddha to the Venerable Pukkhasati is an exposition of a systematic path of practice for the emancipation of the mind from imaginings or Manyana. The discourse begins with the declaration, Chadhaturo Ayang Bhikkhu Puriso. Monk, man as such is a combination of six elements. The worldling thinks that a being, Satta, Sanskrit Sattva, exists at a higher level of reality than inanimate objects. Now what did the Buddha do to explore this concept of a being in his discourse to Venerable Pukkhasati? He literally thrashed out that concept by breaking up this man into his basic elements and defining him as a bundle of six elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, space and consciousness. As the discourse proceeds, he explains it in an extremely lucid manner, how one can detach one's mind from each of these elements. We happen to mention at the very outset that the depth of the Dharma has to be seen through lucidity and not through complicated overdrawings. In fact, this discourse exhibits such a lucidity. The meditation subject of elements, which grew in complexity at the hands of the later Buddhist philosophers, who took to atomistic analysis of a speculative sort, is presented here in this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta with a refreshing clarity and lucidity. Here it is explained in such a way that one can directly experience it. For instance, in describing the earth element, the Buddha gives as examples of the internal earth element such parts of the body as head hairs, body hairs, nails and teeth. Because the external earth element hardly needs illustrations, nothing in particular has been mentioned as to that aspect. Anyone can easily understand what is meant by it. There is no attempt at atomistic analysis. However, the Buddha draws special attention to a certain first principle of great significance. Ya cheva khopana ajhattika pathavidhatu, yacha bahira pathavidhatu, pathavidhatu revesa. Tang netang mamaneso hamasmi nameso attati, eva metang yathabhutang sammapanyaya dattabbang. Eva metang yathabhutang sammapanyaya diswa, pathavidhatu ya nibbindati, pathavidhatu ya chittang virajeti. That which is the internal earth element and that which is the external earth element, they are both just the earth element itself, and that should be seen as it is with right wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Having seen thus with right wisdom as it is, he becomes dejected with the earth element. He detaches his mind from the earth element. It is this first principle that is truly important and not any kind of atomic theory. This resolution of the internal-external conflict has in it the secret of stopping the samsaric vortex of reiterated becoming, samsara vatta. It is due to the very discrimination between an internal and an external that this samsaric vortex is kept going. Now, in the case of a vortex, what is found inside and outside is simply water. But all the same, there is such a vehement speed and activity and a volley of changes going on there. So it is the case with this man. What is found in his body is the earth element. What is to be found outside is also the earth element. And yet the ordinary person sees quite a wide disparity between the two. Why is that? That is because of the illusory nature of consciousness. We have devoted a number of sermons to explain the relationship between consciousness and name and form. We happen to speak of name and form as a reflection of a self-image. Even as one who comes before a mirror, on seeing his reflection on it, would say, "This is mine, this am I, this is myself," the worldling is in the habit of entertaining cravings, conceits and views. In fact, the purpose of craving, conceits and views is to reinforce the distinction between an internal and an external. Already when one says, "This is mine," one discriminates between the this and I, taking them to be separate realities. This am I and this is myself betray the same tacit assumption. Just as by looking at a mirror, one may like or dislike the image appearing on it, these three points of view give rise to various pervert notions. All this because of the perpetuation of the distinction between an internal and an external, which is the situation with the ordinary worldling. Since cravings, conceits and views thus reinforce the dichotomy between an internal and an external, the Buddha has upheld this principle underlying the meditation on the four elements to resolve this conflict. The fact that with the resolution of this conflict between the internal and the external concerning the four elements, the mind becomes emancipated is put across to us in the following verse in the Thalaputta Thera Gatha. Katanu katthe cha tine lata cha khandhe imeham amite cha dhamme adhyattikane vache bahirani cha samang tuleyang tadidang kadame. This verse gives expression to Venerable Thalaputta Thera's aspiration to become an arahant. It says, "When shall I weigh as equal all these limitless things, both internal and external, twigs, grass, creepers, and these aggregates? Oh, when shall that be for me?" It is at the stage of arahanthood that the internal and the external appear alike. That is precisely why the Venerable Adhimutta Thera, whom we quoted earlier, uttered the lines, "Tinakatta samang lokang yada panyaya passati." When one sees through wisdom the world to be comparable to grass and twigs, the comparison is between the internal world of the five aggregates or this conscious body and the inanimate objects outside. Just as in the case of the four elements earth, water, fire and air, the Buddha pointed out a way of liberating one's mind from the space element with the help of similar illustrations. In explaining the space element too, he gives easily intelligible examples. The internal space element is explained in terms of some apertures in the body that are well known, namely those in the ears, nose and the mouth. Apart from such instances, he did not speak of any microscopic space element as in scientific explanations, probably because it is irrelevant. Such an analysis is irrelevant for this kind of reflection. Here we have to bear in mind the fact that perception as such is a mirage. However far one may go on analyzing, form and space are relative to each other like a picture and its background. A picture is vivid against its background, which is relative to it. So also are these two concepts of form and space. Consciousness provides the framework for the entire picture. By way of clarification, we may allude to the pre-Buddhistic attempts of yogins to solve this problem solely through the method of serenity, samatha, ignoring the method of insight, vipassana. The procedure they followed was somewhat on these lines. They would first of all surmount the concept of form or matter through the first four mental absorptions or jhanas. Then as they inclined towards the formless, what confronted them first was space. A very appropriate illustration in this context would be the method of removing the sign of the kasina and attending to the space left by that removal as infinite or boundless, in order to arouse the base of infinity of space. This mode of contemplation of space betrays the fact that space is also something made up or prepared, sankhata. Whatever is prepared, sankhata, is thought out and mind-made, abhisankhataṁ abhisanchetetaṁ. The Buddha proclaimed that there is only one asankhata, unprepared, that is Nibbāna. But later philosophers confounded the issue by taking space also to be asankhata. They seem to have ignored its relation to the mind in regarding causes and conditions as purely external things. Here we see the relativity between form and space. Like the picture and its background, form and space stand relative to each other. All this is presented to us by attention. Manasikara sambhava sabbe dhamma. All things originate from attention. Some of the later speculations about the nature of the space element are not in consonance with the basic principles outlined in the Dhamma. Such a confusion arose probably due to a lack of understanding of the term asankhata. Now, if we are to say something more about this particular discourse, what remains after detaching one's mind from these five elements, namely earth, water, fire, air and space, is a consciousness that is extremely pure. The basic function of consciousness is discrimination. It distinguishes between the bitter and the sweet, for instance, to say this is bitter, that is sweet. Or else it distinguishes between the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral with regard to feelings. This is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Now that the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space, which create discrete objects as the outward manifestation of consciousness, have been totally removed, the residual function of consciousness amounts to a discrimination between the three grades of feeling. The sage who has arrived at this stage of progress on the path to Nibbana takes the next step by observing these three kinds of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and either pleasant nor unpleasant, as they arise and cease dependent on specific contacts, thereby gradually bringing the mind to equanimity. He brings his mind to a stage of radiant equanimity. But even this equanimity he does not grasp by way of mithinking or imagining. The phrase used in this connection is visangyutto nan navedeti. Being detached, he does not experience it. There is a detachment and aloofness even in going through those sensations. This is clearly expressed in that context. For instance, in the case of a pleasant feeling, it is said, anicchati pajanati, anajhositati pajanati, anabhinanditati pajanati. He understands it to be impermanent. He understands it to be uninvolved. He understands it to be unrejoiced. With the understanding of impermanence, conceit goes down. The non-involvement does away with the views. The absence of rejoicing suggests the extinction of craving. So the attainment of arhatthood is in effect the cessation of that consciousness itself. That consciousness is divested of its most primary function of discriminating between the three grades of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither unpleasant nor pleasant. The term visangyutto connotes disjunction, suggestive of dispassion and detachment. In this way, Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta clearly brings out the relevance of the question of manjana to the path leading to nibbana. In some contexts, this practice of desisting from me-thinking or imagining is called atammayata, non-identification. This is the term used by the Buddha throughout the Sappurisa Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. For instance, we read there, Sappurisocha ko bhikkave iti patisankhikkhati neva sanyana sanyayatana samapatti api atammayata buddha bhagavata yena yena hi manyanti tato tam hoti anyathati. The good man reflects thus, the principle of non-identification has been recommended by the Buddha even with regard to the attainment of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. Thus, in whatever way they imagine about it, thereby it turns otherwise. The good man referred to here is the noble disciple on the supramundane path. This term tammaya needs to be clarified in order to understand the significance of this state. It is derived from tadmaya, literally made of that or of that stuff. It is on a par with such terms as sovannamaya, golden, and rajatamaya, silvery. When one has cravings, conceits, and views about something, he practically becomes one with it due to that very grasping. In other words, he identifies himself with it. That is why the person who has imaginings about the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, which he has attained, thinks, I am one who has the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. He thereby has conceit, which is a defilement in itself. As a result, when he loses his mastery of that attainment, he becomes disconcerted. It is for that reason that the Buddha has enjoined that one should cultivate the attitude of atammayata, or non-identification, even with regard to the attainment of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. The arahant is called atammayo in the sense that he does not identify himself with anything. An arahant cannot be identified with what he appears to possess. This is well expressed by the following verse in the Devadutta Vagga of the Anguttara Nikaya. Pasaiya maram abhibhuya antakam yocha phusi jatikkhayam padhanava so tadiso loka vidu sumedho sabbesu dhammesu atammayo muni. That ardent sage who has touched the extinction of birth, having overpowered mara and conquered the ender, that such like one, the wise sage, the knower of the world, is aloof in regard to all phenomena. The idea of this aloofness can be presented in another way, that is, as the detachment from the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized, Ditta Sutta Mutta Vinyata. One of the most important suttas that merits discussion in this respect is the Bahya Sutta in the Bodhi Vagga of the Udana. It is generally acclaimed as an extremely profound discourse. The ascetic Bahya Dharuchiriya comes all the way from far off Supparaka to see the Buddha. When he reaches Jetavana monastery at Savatthi, he heard that the Buddha had just left on his arms round. Due to his extreme eagerness, he ran behind the Buddha and on meeting him, fell prostrate before him and begged, "May the Exalted One preach to me the Dhamma." The Buddha, however, seemed not so responsive when he remarked, "Now it is untimely, Bahya, we are on our arms round." Some might be puzzled by this attitude of the Buddha, but most probably it is one of those skillful means of the Buddha, suggestive of his great compassion and wisdom. It served to tone down the over-enthusiastic haste of Bahya and to arouse a reverential respect for the Dhamma in him. Bahya repeated his request for the second time, adding, "I do not know whether there will be a danger to the exalted one's life or to my own life. For the second time, Buddha refused. It was when Bahya made his request for the third time that the Buddha acceded to it by giving a terse discourse, Sankhitta Dhamma Desana, of extraordinary depth. The exhortation, brief and deep as it is, was quite apt, since Bahya Dharucharya belonged to that rare category of persons with quick understanding, Kippa Abhinya. Tasmat yate bahya evang sikhitabbang ditthe dittamattang bhavisati sute sutamattang bhavisati mute mutamattang bhavisati vinyate vinyatamattang bhavisati evang hi te bahya sikhitabbang yato kho te bahya ditthe dittamattang bhavisati sute sutamattang bhavisati mute mutamattang bhavisati vinyate vinyatamattang bhavisati tato tvang bahya na tena yato tvang bahya na tena tato tvang bahya na tatth यतो त्वं बाह्येन तत्थ ततो त्वं बाह्येनेविध न हुरं न उभयमन्तरे एषेवान्तो दुःखस्स. No sooner had the Buddha finished his exhortation than the ascetic Bahya attained arhanthood then and there. Let us now try to unravel the meaning of this abstruse discourse. The discourse starts off abruptly, as if it has been wrested from the Buddha by Bahya's repeated requests. Tasmat hi bahya evang sikhitabbam. Well then, bahya, you had better train yourself thus. And what is the training? In the seen there will be just the seen. In the heard there will be just the heard. In the sensed there will be just the sensed. In the cognized there will be just the cognized. Thus, bahya, should you train yourself. It is as if the Buddha had addressed the ascetic Bahya in the terminology of the Aryans and established him on the path to Nibbana. Here the term mutta or sensed stands for whatever is experienced through the tongue, the nose and the body. The basic principle in this training seems to be the discipline to stop short at bare awareness, ditthe dittamattang, sute sutamattang, etc. The latter half of the discourse seems to indicate what happens when one goes through that training. The entire discourse is a presentation of the triple training of morality, concentration and wisdom in a nutshell. And when to you Bahya, there will be in the seen just the seen, in the heard just the heard, in the sensed just the sensed, in the cognized just the cognized, then Bahya, you are not by it. And when you are not by it, you are not in it. And when Bahya, you are not in it, then Bahya, you are neither here nor there nor in between. This itself is the end of suffering. As a literal translation, this appears cryptic enough to demand an explanation. Let us first of all give a few clues to unravel the puzzle. The terms by it, tena, and in it, tattha, are rather elliptical. Though unexpressed, they seem to imply the relevance of manjana to the whole problem. As we happened to mention earlier, imaginings or methinkings by way of craving, conceit and views leads to an identification for which the term used is tamyata. Such an identification makes one unsteady, for when the thing identified with is shaken, one also gets shaken up. This kind of imagining in terms of is indicated by the elliptical tena, for we get a clear proof of it in the following two lines from the Jara Sutta in the Attaka Vagga of the Sutta Nipata. Dhono nahi tena manyati yadidam ditta sutam mutesuva. Dhona is a term for the arahant as one who has shaken off all defilements. So these lines could be rendered as follows. The arahant, the one who has shaken off, does not imagine in terms of, that is to say, in terms of whatever is seen, heard and sensed.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible, free of charge, to all who like to listen to them. because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.